The Spectator magazine combines incisive political analysis with books and arts reviews of unrivaled authority. Subscribe today for just £12 and receive a 12-week subscription in print and online. Plus, we'll give you a £20 Amazon gift voucher, absolutely free. Go to spectator.co.uk/voucher.
Hello and welcome to Coffee House Shots, the Spectator's daily politics podcast. I'm Katie Balls and I'm joined by Isabel Hardman and James Heal. We're about to go into the Easter recess and Rishi Sunak, as is custom, has just sat before the liaison committee. Isabel, you've been blogging it for Coffee House. What were the highlights? It was a rather short session by normal standards.
Yeah, it was only 90 minutes and they did keep to time, and it was, I'd say, better humoured than previous ones from him and certainly from some of his predecessors as well. There were still moments of irritation, and as you'd expect, they were generally with opposition MPs, particularly Clive Betts, who's chair of the local government committee, and Joanna Cherry, who he got very cross with, actually, and suggested that one of her questions was part of the increasing threats against MPs, which she obviously didn't take particularly kindly to either. But I'd say it was quite, I mean, there was quite a lot that was covered and quite a lot that came out of it. But in a sense, what came out of it was what the Prime Minister didn't want to say, if that makes sense. So you could read between the lines of what he wanted to comment on and what he didn't want to comment on as to where policy is going well and where it's not going so well. So, for instance, he was very happy to confirm to Stephen Crabb, that who's a Tory MP, that the triple lock would be in the next Conservative manifesto, something we already know, and that it would be maintained for the duration of the next Parliament. And then he added that he saw it as being affordable, but he didn't want to enter into the same sort of discussion with Jeremy Quinn, who's chair of the Defence Committee, and then Bernard Jenkin, about defence spending going up to 2.5%. He stuck to the line that the government has maintained for quite a while of this only being when conditions allow. Now, you talk to lots of Tory MPs and they'll say, well, you know, it's not so much when conditions allow, it's when conditions necessitate. And you can't really get a set of conditions that necessitate defence spending going up more than we have right now. But he was clear that he didn't want to get into manifesto writing in the here and now, having just done it on pensions. So I think that told us quite a lot. And then on Rwanda, you know, his greatest running sore, he was asked by Diana Johnson about the apparent lack of interest from any commercial airline in a what will be an extremely large contract, presumably because despite the conservative assumption that this will be the poll boost they want, no commercial airline wants to touch it because they think their customers will all turn away from them in disgust. And Diana Johnson asked him whether they were going to use the RAF instead. And his response was he wasn't going to get into it for matters of commercial confidentiality, but all the proper planning to operationalise this bill was in place, which was suggesting that RAF flights may have been considered as part of this because he wants to get some kind of plane, whatever sort of plane it is, whether it's just a microlight, into the sky as soon as this bill is enacted.
James, what did you learn?
Well, I think...
if anything.
Well, I think my highlight was the exchange between Will Ragg and Rishi Sunak, which we can listen to now.
Your predecessor, when she says she was undermined by, quotes, the deep state. Is there a deep state? Or are you part of it? Am I part of it?
Yeah, probably a question for her. I probably wouldn't tell you if I was, Will, would I?
No. And we
wouldn't tell anyone else either.
I wouldn't tell anybody else either, Sir Bernard, if I was. So.
And I think that perhaps gives something we don't always see with Rishi Sunak. Often in these occasions, he's been written up as tetchy and, a bit touchy about some of this questioning. But there we saw a bit of the humour that his own team talk about in Number 10. And I think what was so striking today was, as Isabel's written on Coffee House, how much more often Rishi Sunak was keen to talk about, you know, his own past record in different departments, etc. There has been criticism, perhaps, that the Prime Minister is too keen to kind of just talk about Labour's lack of a plan rather than the Tories' own record. And so some within the Conservative Party be saying, hang on a sec. You know, we can't run away from the fact we've been in government 14 years. So actually trying to emphasise some element of continuity as a point of advantage rather than disadvantage was something interesting today, as well as the Truss moment, which I'm sure we've written up as the papers are sort of Sunak jibes at Truss, etc. I think, again, what we saw was a particularly competent and confident session by Sunak at the end of it. He really does enjoy these occasions. It makes one slightly nostalgic for the days of Boris Johnson when, you know, there's obviously a mutual loathing between the select committee chairs. And I think, again, what Wisbell says, you know, the most moments of most pressure for him were on those kind of Tory fault lines. So on defence, for instance, or Liam Byrne pushing about China, those are the issues where the Tory party is really split. So that was the weakness business for him.
And Isabel, as I mentioned in the introduction, we're now heading to the Easter recess. And I think there is a sense, in a way, that everyone is almost, well, not everyone, there are some plotters just going at it. But generally speaking, MPs are keeping their powder dry until the local elections in May, which quite clearly at the moment could be a big danger point for Rishi Sunak. Do you think today's performance, and perhaps, I suppose, if you think back to the really bad week Rishi Sunak had 2 weeks ago, if you think to last week and this week, do you think he has done enough to calm Tory nerves ahead of some bruising local elections?
I mean, I think he's done enough to calm Tory nerves over recess so that they, firstly, he didn't force them to stay late and continue with the Rwanda ping pong when they were all, you know, obviously they're working very hard in their constituencies, but they do also, a lot of them seem to manage to do that whilst also going skiing. So he hasn't delayed anyone's skiing holiday, which is always good for Conservative morale. But in terms of, you know, the fundamental problems when everyone gets back, yeah, they might come back in a better mood, which is you know, really helpful for the Prime Minister. He'll take whatever he can get. But you've still got the issues like defence spending, which I've always seen as a kind of lightning rod in Conservative circles, particularly when they've managed to get Brexit done, for how they're feeling more generally about their party. And defence spending is definitely bubbling up again as a big row. You had James Heapy, the outgoing defence minister, whose job will finish over the Easter recess. He was at Commons Defence Questions yesterday, where he made the case from the dispatch box for higher defence spending. And you've got a lot of Tory MPs getting very worked up about that again. And the Prime Minister's answers today will not have diminished that, because they'll still feel as though they're being fobbed off. And it may well become one of the things that they pour a lot of their energy into after bad local elections. It's interesting when you talk to Conservative MPs who are going out on the doorstep, they say that voters aren't as angry with them as they have been previously. Now, I think that's, you know, that's really looking for the silver lining in an extremely grey cloud, because voters over the past few years have been yelling at them from their front doors about Partygate or about their mortgages, you know, their mortgages going up significantly because of Liz Truss. So I think, you know, voters not chasing them down the street yelling at them, is, if that's the sort of best they can hope for, then that's still pretty depressing for them. But I would say that they're not as demoralised about the local elections as they might be, although there is still time.
James, do you smell danger in the air?
Yeah, I think that the next big pressure point is going to be the May local elections. And I've heard that from MPs across the party. You know, so we wait to see how that's going to be. And it's no surprise then, of course, you've got the Blackpool South by-election. The writ was moved for that same day, 2nd of May, which obviously means that you'd rather have one hit rather than two in terms of the Payne outcome. But, you know, I think this number 10 team has been very good at ensuring that every time there's a moment of political maximum vulnerability, it's then moved on to other things as well. So keeping the MPs occupied, I think that's what's going to be really crucial.
And I suppose, Isabel, just thinking about what counts as a good or bad result for Rishi Sunak in the local elections, there's a lot of focus now on the mayoralities, and almost if you could keep Andy Street, if you keep Ben Houchen, then perhaps they could brush aside some pretty catastrophic results in terms of councils, given the last time around these local elections were taken with a high point of Boris Johnson. Do you think the results are pretty key here in terms of where the plotters come out and say things? And where do you think the party is in terms of the merits of switching to another leader? Because I think it's quite easy to find MPs who are thoroughly depressed with every new poll that comes out, particularly I think Reform Rising and the fact they think that's self-inflicted from number 10's handling on Lee Anderson. But where there seems to be the debate is whether switching leader would be even more harmful to your poll ratings than ploughing on with the current trajectory.
Yeah, just to answer the first point about local elections and the mayoralties, the Conservatives are definitely briefing out or beefing up the focus on Teesside and on the test for Labour in that area. You know, they're trying to underline that Keir Starmer, they say, needs to do particularly well in those local elections to suggest he's got a chance of success in that area, and then in terms of the critical number of seats he needs to win the general election. So I think that's where they're trying to direct attention, which I think is significant. And then in terms of replacing Sunak with another leader, I mean, there have been a few people who've obviously been very keen on that for a while, who've, you know, rented offices and so on. But I think there has been a little bit of a shift in the past few weeks where you've got more MPs not saying it's totally mad. Now, that's not the same as more MPs saying this would be a good idea. But I think what has changed is that some of them are starting to wonder whether it is Sunak himself that is in part at least contributing to the bad poll ratings, as opposed to it being the general picture, the fag end of a party in government, you know, an inevitability, chickens coming home to roost, or whatever the sort of, you know, negative version of a chicken is. And that, I think, has been a bit of a shift. I think there's also, I wrote about this at the weekend, a bit of confusion even from his supporters. When he says unite behind me, their response last week was, well, behind what? You know, which Rishi are we supposed to be uniting behind? You've got the kind of CCHQ attack ad Isaac Levido type Rishi Sunak, which when he tries that on himself never fits. You've got the sort of technocrat Rishi, you've got all sorts of different Rishi Sunaks, and I think we saw a few of them in evidence just at the liaison committee. And it's not clear even from those who kind of will him well, what they're supposed to be going out onto the doorstep and selling, other than the kind of repeated refrain from people who do like him, which is that he's good at spreadsheets, which, I mean, I don't know. You know, I've been on quite a few doorsteps and I've never heard voters say what we need is someone who can really manage an Excel formula.
Though I suppose sometimes when they can't handle the basic competence, you hear it in a different way. Thank you, Isabel. Thank you, James. And thank you for listening.